This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
I'm Angie. Joan and Mike are visiting from Washington, actually. I think of them in Oregon, but they're across the bridge in Vancouver. And we knew each other 11 years ago and are 12 years ago, 20 years ago. Good Lord. For a long, long time anyway. So it's a special pleasure to see you all. And to see you is a very pleasure. So this is a very interesting subject. I got to choose which precept of the five precepts that I could talk about. And I thought about it for a long time and resisted for a long time because the one I chose was one that's fraught in my experience in many different ways, and I realized that I had to do this one and really look at it, which is what the precepts are for, is to really, really look at how things are. There are five of them. No killing, no stealing, no lying. No, what's the fourth one?
Sexual
impropriety. Yes, there are different words for all of these. And no refraining from distilled and fermented intoxicants that cause heedlessness and carelessness. So, when I first heard about the precepts many, many years ago, I was kind of upset because I thought, here's a whole nother bunch of rules to make me a good girl and make me behave, just like the teachers always shook their fingers and said, you know, you've got to do it this way and do it that way. And I thought, no, I don't want to do that. And it made me feel guilty, you know, oh, you shouldn't kill. And then, you know, I was eating things and I was killing flies and smashing mosquitoes. And I thought, oh, you know, how can I do this? It's impossible. But I had a very wonderful teacher, Koben Shino, and he encouraged a lot of sitting. And I think wisdom just arises in our sitting in a very simple and wonderful way. And it soon became clear that what the precepts were talking about was something very, very different. They weren't saying, don't kill. And you don't say when you accept the precepts, I promise I will never, ever in my whole life kill, because it's impossible. And it isn't what it means. It means I vow to stay awake to what I'm doing and thinking when I'm doing and thinking. To notice and not overlook my action and my thought. So as we eat, even if we don't eat meat, we're eating beings. I often wonder what a carrot feels when we pull it out of the ground and eat it. And my teacher said, you know, as we take something in, like a carrot, we're taking in a whole life that we're now turning into our life. And so that virtue in the carrot, we are responsible for, in a way. that its urge to live becomes our urge to live and our dedication to our own life or to life itself, which is what we are. We're the living of the world right now. So this precept is called harmonizing body, speech, life, aligning with wisdom. Because the source of this and all precepts is our own inherent wisdom. They're not really coming from outside. There isn't any outside authority that is telling us that we have to not lie and steal. It's our own wisdom and compassion, our own sense of relationship in the world that gives us the wish to be in harmony with others. The precepts point to our deepest mystery, which is the mystery of me, myself, I, this isolated package of body and blood and bones. But who are all these others? And it's very hard to know when we begin to think about it. And as we think about it, we begin to feel about it, how it feels to be with others, how scary it is often. And how we try to dance a kind of relationship around every single person that we meet. Every single thing that we meet, we're dancing in relationship to in some way. And sometimes it's very artificial. We create a self around ourselves, and we have a story. And then we hold ourselves inside the story and try to relate with others and try to figure out what their story is. So one of the deepest and best parts of our practice is that we learn not to do that so much. We don't have to. It's really not necessary. It's very painful and difficult, really, to do that kind of dance. So learning how to simply sit down and be altogether this without trying to define exactly what this is, because really we don't know, gives us a chance to relate to others in the same way of allowing ourselves not to know, but to find out. What the precepts point out is that we are selfish and we don't like to do that. And it takes an extra effort, just a tiny bit of extra effort, but it does take an extra effort, an extra step. And I think that defines what it is to be a human being, that this is our job as human beings, is to learn how to make that step. In every situation that we're in, just a little bit, but enough to make a difference. This precept of dealing with distilled and fermented and other kinds of intoxicants is very particularly pointing, of course, to stuff. You know, ingested stuff that changes the state of mind. But my teacher translated this as no selling the wine of delusion. So it's not just the delusion of having too much wine. It's the delusion of anything that we cultivate and protect ourselves with and develop as a kind of escape from being, taking that human step. There are many, many different ways to do that, and it's very helpful to think about it. How we cloud our mind, which is another translation, no clouding the mind. We can cloud our mind by watching TV for 5 hours. And there are many, many different versions of this. That's what this precept is really all about. It's about how we willingly delude ourselves, step away from the situation we're in, and fail to engage. So there's another version of the in Zen, which are called the Bodhisattva precepts or the Bodhidharma precepts. And this one goes, self-nature is mysterious and profound. Not arousing ignorance is to refrain from intoxicants. Not arousing ignorance. So the precepts are all pointing us over and over to what's going on in our mind. That's what they are. They aren't telling us to be perfect beings, because we can't be. They aren't asking that we do a perfect job of any of it. It's not about that. It's about paying very close attention and willing and gracious and grateful attention to how our mind works as we work our way through the world and do the connections, make the connections that we make through our life. If it's not harmonious, we suffer terribly, and everyone around us suffers too. So my real vivid experience personally is about smoking cigarettes. I loved to smoke cigarettes. I loved it so much. And I learned how at the age of 18, and by the age of 20, I was smoking 3 packs a day. And on college campus, they were giving away Winstons. You know, they gave little packets away. So how could you not? And besides, you held it in your fingers, and that was sophisticated, you know. It gave you a little oomph. And then you shared a fire with somebody. You struck a fire, and you had it in your hand. And then the smoke went up, and you could blow the smoke. Everything about it was just so fabulous. And then I had 3 kids, 3 little boys. I lived out in the country where we kept a fire going to keep ourselves warm. And one night, I ran out of cigarettes. I was already in my nightgown, and it was pouring rain outside. And I didn't even get dressed. I got in the car and I drove all the way to town to buy another pack of cigarettes so I'd have one in the morning with my coffee. And on the way home, I thought, this owns me. It owns me. I'm not even doing this. It's making me do this. This is terrible. So it took a long time to get out of it. Long, long time. I had to get the Asian flu and be so sick I couldn't smoke for 2 weeks, and then I was done with the physical part. But even now, I still remember how much I loved it. And it was an addiction, one, But it was also a kind of cloudy way of being something that I wasn't really being at all. It was just a thing. It was just a thing that you do, that you put into your life in order to make your life stirring and vivid and important and big in some kind of way. And our practice is not about being big. Our practice is finding our own size, our own shape, and just being that. It's a very modest thing, really, and you find the people that you meet who practice are very modest people. You don't have to show anything more than you really are, because that's so special already. So the precepts are connecting with our wisdom over and over again. We lie through our teeth. In fact, the truth is that we can never really say the truth. The truth is beyond us. It's untalkaboutable. And as far as stealing is concerned, if we begin to think about what ownership is, we don't really own anything. Everything is in our hands to take care of for a little while, but it's all going to go somewhere else sometime. So they're all pointing to the reality of how we are and allowing us to be come back to being real over and over. It's like sitting. When our mind drifts off, we can come back and just be present. And the precepts are doing the same thing. They're bringing us back over and over. Oh, this is where I am. This is how it is. And with this one, our refraining is to refrain from anything that is addictive to us. And discovering what that is sometimes hard because it's so attractive. There's so many attractive things, and we live in such an intensely almost blatant kind of culture where everything is happening and everything is possible. We can do anything, it feels like, or we're encouraged to want to do everything, including eating and drinking and carousing and partying and all of those things. So taking this one to heart especially affects the other ones, I think, all the other four. That if we see it all the time, the news of the drunken girl who is so drunk she gets raped. I mean, it just creates the worst kind of horrible problems without even the drop of a hat. It's so simple and so devastating to people's lives. In Zen practice, we don't say that this is a total restriction, any more than the other ones are. That we don't say you should never touch a drop, like old grandpa used to say. But we always talk about care and attention and what we do, whether it's eating or drinking or tending our children or working in the garden. So I found it a sort of flowery way of talking about the precepts as a joyful method of cultivating the heart, nurturing harmony in relationships, and freeing the mind from greed, hatred, and delusion. that are causing so much suffering to the self and to others. That's the crux of it. How much suffering? In my family, there was a lot of suffering around alcohol. Horrible, really. And all the ways that it affects not only the person, but all the other people who are involved. It's like rings in a pool. It just travels and travels. Just as whatever we do travels in that way. So again, these are pointing to how we need to be mindful of the effect we have on others and on ourselves, to take care of this and find ways of feeling safe so that we don't have to stun ourselves in a way that creates harm and unwholesomeness. It's a wonderful challenge. In Zen, we have 10 precepts. So you all lucked out in the Vipassana tradition. You only have to learn 5 of them. The fifth one, the ninth one for us, is no being angry, which is everybody's favorite, of course. And the Bodhisattva, Bodhidharma version of that is self-nature is mysterious and profound. No, there is no difference between self and other. There is no difference between self and other. That's what happens when we get angry, is we're proposing that there is a difference. And my point of view is the right one. And you are something else, something different. And it creates a sense of separation. And I think anger also is creating a kind of clumsy effort to make a connection, to roar and try to reach over and yell your point of view so they really get it. You know, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And that can become an addiction as well. Always trying to be right. Always trying to have the correct point of view. So soft, mild, modest. Very different from what we're used to. But then we come to a space like this and sit down with each other in a place like this and a practice like this and look at us. It's wonderful. So how to continue this? How to maintain this? How to be this? Not get caught. Not get spun around by all the spinning that's going on. We don't have to. But it takes effort. So that's what I brought to say tonight. There's lots of time for discussion. I hope you have lots to say.
Angie, I would appreciate it if you could say a little bit more about this difference between the dance around that we sometimes get caught in versus being in relationship and harmony with others. I'm not clear what the dancing around piece is.
It's based on our fear of others, our anxiety in the world. It's a very anxious place, and there's so much we don't know. And so we grow up into our ignorance and then try to cover it up and pretend that we know things that we don't, pretend that we are things that we aren't, and create a presentation of ourself in the world that's all cobbled together by ideas that we create and keep trying to adjust as things happen, so that we say, oh, I wouldn't do that, or I didn't say that, or, you know, I hope they didn't notice that because it didn't fit the picture. We try in our dancing around to connect without really connecting. Really connecting takes time and intention, really meaning to. It's like the difference between seeing a flower and saying, there's a flower, and just stopping and being with the flower for a minute. We can do that with each other, but we don't usually. It's a surface thing, and we just think we know. We think we know ourselves, we think we know everybody else too as we meet. But if we met as mysteries to each other, then we would be wondering, what's happening with you? How are you? Who are you? It makes life so much more interesting and so much more real. Yeah.
Give her questions. She's a master.
I'd like to hear a little bit more about the other five precepts.
Well, we say, maybe I should say first, that in order to receive the precepts, we take refuge first. So that's the first step. And in Zen, we even have a firster step before the refuges, when we admit ourselves. We say, all my ancient wrong actions arising from beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance based on mind, speech, and body, altogether I now fully avow. Doesn't say I'm never going to be like that, whatever that is, again. It doesn't mean that. It just means I'm acknowledging that I'm a human being and it's kind of a mess. It's always been a mess. It always will be a mess. And I accept and avow that. And then I return to Buddha and return to Dharma and return to Sangha. And from there, we step into the precepts. So then we say, and in Zen, or in my teacher's tradition, we say, don't say, I vow not to kill. We don't say that. We say, no killing. No killing life. No stealing. No telling lies. No sexual misconduct. and then this one about addiction. So killing is always evokes an enormous discussion about how to live, because we're killing all the time and we're in danger of being killed all the time, and how can we do this? And it doesn't mean not to kill. It means acknowledging it and knowing clearly what we do when we do it as best we can. But the poor Janes, they have a little broom and they walk with a sweeping in front of themselves, trying to get rid of anything that they might destroy with their feet. But, you know, if they wipe their eyebrows, there are vast populations living in our eyebrows. You just do this and you're killing them all off. We can't avoid it. There's no way. And there's no need to. But certainly there's a need to be grateful. As we sit to eat, to be grateful for where the food came from, who it came from, and then make it into something good. So no stealing, as I said, is just about acknowledging that we don't own anything really. So we take very good care of it as best we can. And when we have to get rid of it or give it up, we give it up. That's really hard. You know, we talk about generosity all the time, but I know somebody who practiced with Pema Chodron, and she was very happy to go and do this retreat. And the first thing Pema asked was that they bring something really precious to them and put it on the altar. And so they all did, and they were all on the altar for the whole time of the week of retreat. And then when the retreat was over, they were all waiting to get their things back. Her grandma's beautiful gold watch is still there. So it's hard. It's hard, but it's the truth of things. It's the actual truth. And in my olding age, I am more and more aware of it, that everything around me that has been given is going to go somewhere else sooner than later, that I have to start thinking about where else it's going to go, which is really strange. It's not mine. You know, this night's table, well, somebody's going to want that. That's interesting. It's my table? No, it's not really my table. It just came to me. Sexual misconduct. That's another tricky one. They're all powerful. These are all based on the earliest practice with Shakyamuni Buddha. That when they got together, they were just gathering around Buddha and his teachings. But they were human beings, and so things began to happen. And as things began to happen, they got worried about it. And somebody went to Buddha and said, you know, somebody, that guy over there, he took my razor and he didn't even ask. And Buddha said, called everybody together, we better have a little discussion about this, and maybe we can agree that we won't take anything that isn't given. So 2,500 years later, we are still saying so. We do not take what is not given. That's the precept. So in the sexual misconduct, if you read the Vinaya, there's a list of over 200 stories. The rules that they came up with and the stories that caused them. And a great many of them are the weirdest sexual stories you ever read. They're really amazing. So when things happened, they went to Buddha and they got together and they said, maybe this wasn't such a good idea. So it was about things that affected everybody else as well as affected the person himself. So it was about harmonizing the relationships. It's all about harmonizing relationship. That's the basis of it. And the harmony comes from each person, each one.
There isn't an answer to this, but I have. I'm wondering about difficult people in my life. I've got a few of them, part of me thinks, well, I should be better. I should be able to see this person and be, you know, in harmony and blah blah blah. But at the moment, what's quote unquote true for me is I'm not there. I tell myself, you know, right now these people are not nourishing for me. I wish they were. I recognize it's my own defensiveness or lack of self-worth or whatever. The problem is me. I do get, you know, I get that. It's not them. But the fact remains, I don't want to see these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm in situations where it's difficult not to see them, you know, they're going to show up at a party or somebody else wants to invite them or what, I'd appreciate any thoughts you have about what can I do?
Well, I've often said that it's very well, all the great teachings, the great religious teachings are that we should love others as we love ourselves, but it doesn't mean we have to like them all. And we don't. You know, we have different needs as different kinds of people, and so some fulfill our needs and some don't. So it's not a bad thing to feel like that. You don't have to blame yourself or them. You can just bow to them. You know, the way you do on the freeway when somebody cuts in front of you. Just be my guest, whatever. You know, that's the way you are. So you can just let them be the way they are. You don't have to go out of your way to, unless they're in deep need, and then you can put your hand out if you want to. But I don't think, because of the teaching of compassion, that it means that we have to be good friends with everybody, except on the deepest level. On a deep level, we do connect, whether we know we do or not. On a deep level, you know everybody and they know you. Our bellies know it. The air around us is charged with it. We are charged between each other. But because of the things that are our conditioning, what's happening in our own mind often doesn't even notice the charge. So cultivating a deeper understanding of ourself is very, very helpful. Learning to feel that charge, learning to recognize the conditioning when it comes up. Oh, I know why I feel like that. So that it's not such a black and white kind of situation. It becomes more interesting that way.
So do you have any advice for those of us raising children, teens now?
Gosh.
For this first precept about avoiding intoxicants, and I'm not talking about alcohol or drugs. I'm thinking more like video games.
Mm-hmm.
Electronics is basically what I call it. And, you know, I can model bad behavior in that area as well. You know, I've gotten to this point where I just like to have the TV on for the noise. You know, I don't feel alone when it's on.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we've gotten to the point where we're eating in front of the TV and we're just, we have our computers on in front of the TV and, or my daughter's on her phone, or, I mean, it's just like electronics has, can take over our lives. And,
I think that's true all over the Bay Area for sure.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I mean, part of it, I know what I'm doing and I didn't grow up that way. So I know, you know, life before all these electronics, and when I need to, I can, you know, shut it off. But the kids, they grew up with all this stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess just wondering if there's, if you have any advice for, as a parent, how we can kind of guide our children, you know, maybe to be just at least be more mindful about what they're doing with the electronics, how they're maybe, you know, well, for example, I often have to remind my daughter, you know, when we're out to eat, you know, put your phone away. We're not texting and, you know,
yes,
while we're eating.
Yes.
So, like, just to be more mindful of the people around her and also how much it is a time suck and she could be doing something else. Yeah.
Well, I had rules for my boys. No, they didn't watch TV except on Saturday morning. And then we got to sleep in, and they got to get up and watch cartoons and make their own breakfast of dry cereal. Right? It was a big treat for them. But otherwise, we didn't do TV. And we didn't have any of the other stuff then. But I know young men, I know several young men who are totally addicted and cannot stop playing games, in a way that looks like they're drinking all the time. It's the same kind of thing. It's just taken over their whole life. They can't do anything else. They can't keep a job. It's very scary, really, to see, because it's so powerful. It has such a grip. In my neighborhood, there are a lot of families with young children, and what I'm noticing is that they get them involved in a lot of things else, out of the house, dancing, sports, mountain climbing, you know, getting something to challenge them that's not online somehow.
I think actually, you know, I've gone back and forth, I've tried rules, I've tried everything, and some days you just, oh, forget it. But I think I have been trying to get them out more, and, you know, doing, like, we signed up at the gym and got my son into a train club. So anyway, I think that's helpful, that sometimes it's easy to think of rules and you're not going to do this anymore, but they resist that, of course.
Yeah.
And it's like when you put the precept in the positive.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, I think that's helpful.
Yeah, so let's do this instead.
Yeah.
Hold this other shiny thing up.
You can't have your electronics in the swimming pool.
Yes, right. Let's leave them back at the house and just swim.
Yeah.
So it becomes a different kind of thing.
I just think it's an ongoing battle.
Well, it is for everybody. I think it's just the way the world is right now.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll piggyback on that. On this topic of intoxicants that cloud the mind, it occurs to me, and you've mentioned things like this a bit, but We can be clouded by any of the sensual experiences that we have, mm-hmm. you know, and so the young people are clouded by their attachment to the tech pieces, but we can actually be very clouded by food or
yes, that's a big one,
or pleasures of the tactile sense. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of ways.
Yeah, there's sexual addictions. That's a big, serious problem. There are AA programs for everything you can imagine now. You know, it's just, and some of them are wonderful programs. They help people stop and look at what they're doing and why. Because if you don't know why, you just keep on doing it. You know, you can't just say no, no to yourself, much less to your kids. You have to find out why you're doing what you're doing. And that's a painful process often. Often you're doing whatever it is because you don't want to know. Because it's a painful place and it's hard to face the painful places. But that's where our liberation lies, in facing the truth of things. Really facing it and letting it be like it is. And seeing the wholeness of it, how it fits into the wholeness of everything. We're not separate. We're not alone. We just feel that way. So best way is to step back and look carefully and closely and lovingly at what's going on. And then be willing to reach out, even without knowing exactly what's happening, and just find out. Be surprised, I often say. Just let every moment be a surprise. We really don't know what's going to happen next. We think we do, but we don't. We couldn't have imagined how we're like this right now, could we? Did we? No. It's amazing. So that's underneath the cardboard mind, you could say. The one that has this little fake picture of everything that we're going to do. And just being with the way it really is. Wow. Here we are.
What you say about understanding why we do things and looking at what's underneath. I have an ex-daughter-in-law who was brought up by a shopping addict.
That's another one, yes.
Yeah, and I think that the mom is still doing that and has now gotten herself and her husband into huge, huge debt that another daughter is trying to help them get out of. Mm. But my ex-daughter-in-law has inherited that addiction, which is a lot of what drove her marriage to my son apart and ended it. And even though since that time she's been through therapy and a lot of work, addiction work, and all sorts of insight-oriented, not Buddhist meditation insight, but insight, personal work, to try and look at all of these issues, and she knows them and can recite them and can say, oh yes, I know, that's me. But without an alternative, you know, it's such an ingrained part of her.
Yeah.
So as soon as she gets into a vulnerable space, you know, she falls right back into trying to fill that hole that she was always hoping shopping would fill.
Mm-hmm.
And you speaking about the cause, it's culture-wide, it's system-wide.
Oh, yes.
And so we can see it on our level, but when it's in the culture, and the bottom line of our culture is more, it takes superhuman strength, I think.
I agree.
To get out of it. If
yes.
you've never existed out of it, if that's all you've known, you know, it's daunting.
Yeah. You're expected to be that way because that's what keeps the whole industrial complex going. And so all the advertising is set up to make us a little uncomfortable with ourselves, which we already are, but we'll feel a lot better if we get this particular toothpaste. So we have to go out and buy these things in order to feel better because they need us to do that in order to keep the financial system going. That's exactly right. So the only way I can see out of it, and it's the very first principle in Buddhism, is generosity. That if you know you've got that in you, that you just have to go and practice giving everything away. Do a potlatch every 5 minutes or something, you know. Or pay for people ahead of you in the line or anything that takes, because giving breaks that attachment. It cuts it, and it hurts often. It's hurtful to give things. It actually, because we're holding on so tightly, and we're protecting ourselves. And as long as she's thinking that she's the one she thinks she is, she will be wanting to do that all the time.
But there's a backside to that generosity too, because she considers herself an extremely generous person, and in spirit she is. Trouble is, she doesn't have anything for herself. And so she'll give time that she should be focusing on her own well-being. Mm-hmm. She'll give the teeny bit of resources, once she gets a hold of them, to somebody instead of trying to
yes.
stabilize herself. You know, so generosity, absolutely, but you gotta have some sense of stability, your sense, and of yourself.
You have to have
do
a
that
self,
wisely.
Yes. You have to be a self, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
are you in touch with her?
Up until the last couple of weeks, intensively in touch with her. Yes, we've supported her for the last year in trying to help her get on her feet.
Mm.
But I think she's fallen into a hole again. Mm. So, then the question comes up, how much more can
yes.
we do this?
Yes.
You know, when it seems that there's a bottomless hole in her. You know, it's just... I mean, we want to be generous, and we have been, but are there limits to that? You know, it's a real tough question.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. That's hard. Yeah.
It is hard.
Huh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just even on the way here at 7 o'clock, I have my phone up because I wrote down the name of the book. The speaker was a heroin addict or cocaine addict for 4 or 5 years. Did you hear that?
Mm.
And she's written a book, and I mean, she got out of it like over 20 years ago. But she has a book out, and it's called Unbroken Brain. And her name is Maya. I didn't get her last name. But it's all about how to deal with addiction and the latest research, because the willpower is usually not enough. It's the chemistry in the brain
So they're finding out a lot more about addiction, but the programs haven't really caught up with it yet. Yeah. So anyway, I just realized that if you're interested in that topic, there's this book that just came out, and I'm sure there's more, but that one's in the news right now.
So it's about breaking an addiction.
Yes.
Finding ways to how to do it.
And then also what the latest research is. She's, mm-hmm. She's a journalist. She's been writing about that topic in health for over 20 years. And she talks about the types of sensory profiles that children have that tend to get addicted to things. Yeah, and I only heard, of course, bits and pieces. I didn't hear the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I heard enough to write down the book and I'm going to read about it.
Yeah.
Your story made me think about my brother is with someone that everybody in my family, all his friends, think is very bad news for him. And, you know, he's an adult. He has a successful career. He's, you know, and so part of me thinks, hey, you know, I've got to go with this. What I was thinking about was enabling versus, you know, am I enabling, as I agree with them, I think this woman is terrible for him, is really bad news. So, you know, and he'll say, oh, will you, you know, see her? Will you have lunch with her? Will you? And I think, you know, I don't want to do that.
I think it's another one of these situations. There isn't answers to these difficult
situations, but any thoughts you have would be appreciated.
Well, again, it's trying to find the harmonizing way without trashing yourself or the other person. So you have to take care of yourself. And if you care about him, you have to at least wish him a lot of well. And sometimes that's all you can do. And just let him know that you're there for him. Because if she's really horrible, it won't last. And that'll be hard for him. So breaking off because of something isn't usually a good idea. But stepping back, if you have to step back, often helps. And just make sure that it's known that you're there for him. And that you love him. I mean, it happened with my oldest son, the same thing. A really, really crazy lady. Very, very beautiful and irresistible. He could not see anything but her beauty and did not realize how really seriously ill she was until they'd had a child and gone through a lot of drama. And slowly it began to dawn on him, but it took a long time. And he was very mad at me because I was supporting them in my mind, but from a distance. I was not going there because I couldn't. And that's being honest. Again, you can love without liking. No, just let it be. And hope for the best. You really do have to. Keep them in your mind. She might get better. We never know.